Radio on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on www.cqut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, or on the second Thursday of every month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio or finding help searching for past programs, email prison@cqut.ca.
Prison Radio Show here on CQUT. Prison Radio seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggle by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging our ideas about what prisons are, as well as about the people inside our jails. My name is Candace, and I'll be your host for today's show. Today we'll be airing an interview with Eric McDavid, a green anarchist who served almost 10 years in U.S. federal prisons after being entrapped by an FBI informant. Eric was released in January of 2015 after a judge vacated his conviction and sentence. But first, we're going to check in on a few news headlines, these stories we've been reporting on regularly for the past few months. So the hunger strike that we reported on last month in Ohio's state penitentiary has ended. The last hunger striker ended their strike on April 24th. According to LucasvilleAmnesty.org, most of the strikers ended their strike on April 15th after a meeting with the warden in which he agreed to list some of the new restrictions that the men were facing. the Ohio State Penitentiary opened as Ohio's first super maximum security facility in 1998. Conditions for the over 400 men held there are more restrictive than on Ohio's death row. For more information about the hunger strike, you can check out lucasvilleamnesty.org. According to Kenneth E. Hartman, who is currently incarcerated in California, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation has begun denying contact visits to visitors who refuse to submit to a strip search after a positive scan from an ion scanner. Ion scanners are notoriously unreliable, and Hartman speculates that the department is, in fact, attempting to do away with contact visits for prisoners in its system altogether. For more information, you can check out the op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times by Hartman about these new policies. So Eric McDavid is a green anarchist who was sentenced to 19 years in 2007 after he was entrapped by an FBI informant and charged with a single count of conspiracy to use fire or explosives to damage corporate and government property. He was unexpectedly released from prison in January 2015 after a judge found that the prosecution had withheld evidence during his trial. The Prison Radio Show caught up with Eric in March of 2015.
Hey, I'm Eric McDavid, green anarchist that was wrapped up back in 06 in what a lot of people would call an entrapment case, which was pretty much politically motivated.
So let's start before 2006. Do you want to talk a bit about, like, how you got politicized, how you came to have the politics that you had when you got arrested in 2006?
Okay. So it started way back in actually September 11th in 2001 with the events that took place in New York and the United States. I was driving to work that morning. I was doing carpentry, and it really struck me as, like, not being able to find, like, a frame of reference for why those people would do that. And so I had no political background at that time. I was in that space where the government did whatever the government did because they were professionals and they knew what they were doing. And so why would I trouble myself with something like that? And so I was basically just pretty much really mainstream and just working 10 hours a day and then drinking beer and smoking pot and then doing it again. And when I was driving to work that morning, and out here on the West Coast, it was like 6:30 in the morning. The person on the radio that was doing it was like a general radio station. They were talking about the inadequacies of the medium of radio and, like, what their purpose was and like how really confusing it was for them to be conveying these, like, really dramatic and really serious and intense things that were happening in New York. And so, like, part of that was, like, really, like, a culture shock for me too, because the DJ was just like, yeah, we're here for entertainment. We're not here for news. So I don't know exactly what I'm doing with this right now. And, like, trying to, I don't know how to talk about this. And he was, like, genuinely confused and, like, totally disorientated by this shift that was happening within him around, like, conveying what was happening. Part of that, like, shook my frame of reference on an even deeper level that I wasn't even conscious of at that time. So, like, that slowly began to integrate. I started asking a lot more questions about what would motivate someone to do that and how could anything really be so dramatic as to make it so that that type of action would seem as, like, efficient and logical. And that started a whole bunch of questioning into, like, looking into history a little bit more and the role of government and how those two things kind of blended together to create the political, like, existence of the mainframe of today. After that, after learning a bunch about that and like how I think it was Michael Moore's book, Dude, Where's My Country? Something to that effect. I started reading that, and then all the hypocrisies around the practices of government and how bureaucracy moves backwards and says it moves forwards at the same time. A lot of that questioning came out, and then I got wrapped up in like anti-war movement that was going on, and actually went to my first like huge march. It was an anti-war march on October 25th down in San Francisco, and where like over a quarter million people came out in support of not going to war. That like community that I felt during that march was something that was simply amazing, because I mean everyone was looking out for each other. Everyone was like, hey, you need water, you good, you got any food, you doing okay, and like checking in with people. And so there was this like authenticity about it that I hadn't felt since I was like a kid. And also like everyone was there with one intent, and that simply just blew me away. I hadn't experienced that since I was a kid, and so I decided, okay, this is something that I definitely want to pour some energy into, and did all these fucking nonviolent de-escalation, civil disobedience, how to deal with police skill shares, and like even so far as doing like a train to the trainer skill share on de-escalation practices. And so like after that, started doing like security for the marches, and after a while kind of got a little burnt out on that, seeing no impact from that type of action, and got really burnt out on it. And then just kind of like one of the times that there was a march, I just didn't do any security for it. I just participated in the march, and I was walking around a little tabling section, and this person comes up with like this Maoist newspaper, and they see that I have this Answer shirt on, and Answer was one of the main coalitions, I use that word loosely, coalitions for the marches that were going on in the Bay Area at that time. And I take the paper, shoot them a dollar, and they were like, hey, you know that Answer is just another like Trotskyist vanguard, right? Or Leninist vanguard. I was like, oh, I just played it off. Oh, yeah. No, it's just a cool shirt. I don't really care about all that, and yada, yada, yada. And then, like, after I got the paper, I was just kind of like, oh, after they walked away, I was like, I felt like I'd gotten got again. Like, someone else just got me. Because prior, it was like the government had gotten me into a false trust in believing that they were doing actually what my best interests were. And then now, I just learned that the folks that put on all these marches weren't just trying to like get folks together against the war and like call it naive, call it whatever. That was just where I was at. I felt like betrayed by them. And so I was like, oh, hell no. So I'm reeling everything back. I just stayed like really local with any support and energy stuff I was doing, putting energy into like Students for Peace at the local junior college where I was attending, and some of the local peace groups that are just in the area and helping them out. And then it was a little while after that that I was at one of the Students for Peace meetings, and there's this person sitting next to me, and he's stacking these pieces of paper, and he's got this huge stack of piece of paper, got script on it, whatever, and he's like taking like sections of them, stapling it in the middle, folding it in half, and just doing that again, staple in the middle, fold it in half, set it off to the side, making these little booklets. And it's on the face of it is like this almost like androgynous or like almost female bodied person with like metallic dreads. And I'm looking at it, and like underneath that or above it, I can't remember, it says species traitor. And I was like, species traitor. I mean, I was more than familiar with like the idea of like treason and like traitor to the state and everything, but species traitor was like a whole different level that I had no like idea. So I was like, hey, you mind if I see one of those? He's like, oh, here, you just have it. So I looked at it and I just threw it in the bag for coffee later on and continued on in the meeting. But when I started reading that, that was like my first interactions with a more holistic cultural critique. The authors looked at the culture and critiqued it, but they also looked at themselves and critiqued themselves from the viewpoints that they placed on the culture. And so with that intensity of a critique and that full of a critique, it just really resonated as something like beyond authentic compared to all the other like sociopolitical relationships that I'd experienced prior. And so that was when I like really started to look into and study a bunch more about anarchism. So from there, it was just like a big downhill run, basically, because I felt like I'd found something that had a correct political analysis that was orientated not to itself, but to the culture at large. From there, it was just like, okay, then I just learned about like alternative ways of travel, alternative ways of finding food, and a whole bunch on alternative ways of looking at gender and looking at power structures and difference of power with and power over and healthy communication styles and patterns that actually nourish relationships. And so all of that really just kind of opened the door to experiencing it hands-on, and I started traveling not too far long after that.
Can you talk a bit about your case, just like a bit of an overview for people who haven't heard anything before?
Yeah, sure. So far as the case goes, you can always visit my website, supporteric@wordpress.com or .org. There is ample documentation on the case, especially court records, court transcripts, like everything that happened with the court process is on the website and open for view. So far as the case, ended up running into a government agent who was 18-year-old female bodied person very early on when I first started traveling. Then over time developed like a huge crush on her, which was greatly fueled by like her actions. And like the first night that I met her, she was like, everyone's sitting up outside on the front porch, like having a beer and a cigarette, just chatting it up. And it's not even getting terribly late. And she comes up to me and goes, "Hey, so when are we going to bed?" And it's just kind of like, and I'd like met her like earlier on that day. We'd like talked for a little bit. And then so I was like, looked at my buddy and he's just like, "I don't know what the hell." And so I was just like, okay, well, as soon as I finish the cigarette, I'm going to be ready to go to bed. And she was like, all right, cool, I'll see you up there then. And it was just kind of like, all right. That was like the initial hook thrown in. I don't know. It's just kind of like where it's at, where that started with. After that, it was just like a whole bunch of manipulation and coercion. Basically, the FBI justifying spending all the money that they did following me around the country and monitoring me. And after a fair lick of time, which wasn't even a year, or about a year and a half, she'd, through the FBI, got a cabin up in the mountains, which was fully set for video and vocals, or video and audio, and drove everyone up there, gotten people across the country, bought all the food, all the supplies, and therein began to like seal the case. After an event where the physical evidence was lost, she really freaked out, and it was like over the course of like 5 days that we were in the cabin, and on the last night, that's when it happened, where she kind of freaked out due to the loss of the physical evidence that they were going to use, they would have used against me in a trial. And the next morning, while we were, well, after she'd driven us down to town, given us money to buy, go and buy more supplies, they swooped us up in a Kmart parking lot, and it was with all the fanfare and glory that the FBI and JTTF enjoy to exude whenever they can. Multiple SUV vehicles, majority of the JTTF in full SWAT gear, AR-15s. None of us were armed, of course. They could have just as easily walked up in suits and proceeded to take us to an FBI station, to where none of us made any comments at that time. And then, like, with the request of lawyers, got sent down to, they drove us down to Sacramento County jail. And, like, right before they drove into the underground garage, I was in the SUV with a task force sheriff driving, and then the FBI agent sitting next to me. And the FBI agent turns to me and goes, "Hey, we always go easy on the one that flips first." And just like, "Oh, talking to the wrong person." But apparently they talked to some people, and they got to some people with that one. So Lauren flipped shortly after that, I learned. I actually didn't learn it until about 3 months later. Zach did 9 months in isolation and broke after that. They were basically, "Yeah, well, you can be out of here if you just sign over. It's all you have to do is sign over, and we'll send you up north, back up to Washington, no problem." And sure enough, as soon as he signed over, he was on a plane or a bus ride or a van ride. I don't know if they drove him up there. I did 28 months in isolation over the whole period. Wrapped up Friday the 13th, full moon, by the way, on January of 06. And trial was in September of 07. September 10th through, like, I want to say, like, the 27th, I believe. Only which there was, like, only 10 days of trial throughout the whole process. Three of which was the jury's deliberations. Found guilty after some really interesting interactions with the judge and the jury, especially around jury instructions at the end of the trial. Got sentenced 08, May of 08, early May, I want to say May 7th, because it was like on my mom's birthday, which was classic, to 235 months in prison with the terrorist enhancement. It topped out, the charge of conspiracy topped out at 240 months, but with the terrorist enhancement of the charge I was found guilty under, it started at 235 months. So the judge had like a 5-month window to sentence me, and during the sentencing he said he would have had no problem giving me the 396 or 390 that would have came without the limitation for conspiracy. After that, a couple weeks went by, and then got sent off to Victorville.
Victorville's in California?
Yeah, it's in Southern California. It was all federal prisons that I was at. They denied me bail because I knew how to hitchhike and hop on trains. That was like the main reason. And the second main reason that they wouldn't give me bail is because I didn't have any family ties. They said because I didn't have a cell phone with me when I traveled, I was in jail the whole time in isolation.
So you spent 28 months in isolation, and I guess I'm curious if people on the outside were able to garner support for you pretty quick. Like, were you getting letters from folks on the outside? Did you have access to a phone? What was being in isolation like at the beginning there?
Support throughout this whole thing has been breathtakingly beautiful and amazing, and just the amount of community support that I've received throughout this whole process continues to amaze me in like the most beautiful ways, and I always have like this huge ass smile on my face whenever I think about it. So especially right at the beginning, it was beautiful. like the FBI was holding my mail, like processing all my mail that was coming in. And so I'd get like batches like once a week or once every 2 weeks. The way the cops pass out the mail in ISO out there is like they do it at like two or three in the morning, and they just shove it under the cell door. And there was like more than a couple of times, more than a handful of times, that the CO would actually pop the door open, get me up out of bed, and hand me this brick of mail and be like, how the fuck do you get this much mail? I mean, it was literally like a brick, like a good 4-inch tall stack of mail with a rubber band about it around it. And they'd always be like, how do you get this much mail? How do you get this much mail? I don't get this much mail in a year. And so it was just kind of like, thank you, have a good night. Now I have like my week's mail. So support has been like a beautiful experience throughout this, and a huge window into like the real like strength and intent within our community. So ISO was really, it was lonely, but I've got like, I can kind of do like the introverted thing. So it wasn't terribly like impacting upon me in that way, and like the isolating way. I kind of had done like a whole bunch of work on myself prior to that, so I didn't really have much of a problem chilling with myself, despite it being for quite a bit of a duration. Yeah, and I mean, issues always come up and you always like spin on stuff, but like overall, like the work that I'd done on myself was priceless in order to like help nourish, along with all that community support, the isolation that I was experiencing at that time. You'd get out of the cell maybe once every 3 days. It really depends on what cop is working. Sometimes it's like twice a day. Sometimes it's like once a week. Sometimes it was a little bit longer than that. If they had lockdowns, there was no way you were getting out for anything. Get outside. I put that in quotations just because it's like you're not breathing recycled air. Like in a three-walled, huge concrete box with a big old small chain link fence that is like facing the outside with tarps covering the bottom part so you can't really see out, but between the tarps, if you can get that close to the wall without the cops like yelling at you. So yeah, that was 28 months of just, I mean, you got access to phones whenever you're out in the day room during those once a day, once every 3 days, once a week type things. And you got access to showers during that time too. But hell, half the time I was in the cell so much, you just bird bathed after like your workout or your yoga. And so like you just, a lot of it like was me just having to pay attention to like, okay, so how am I going to be able to dance with this small of an environment right now? And so it felt like I just had to like take care of my body and take care of my mind. And I didn't have to worry about my spirits and my heart because I had all that support at the time. So I was just like, okay, so like it or not, I'm going to have to start working out and doing yoga and doing Tai Chi or Qigong, just some, like some energy work to help my body stay healthy. And I need to keep my mind sharp and active because, well, all this shit that's going on around me, I don't really want to like get lax at this point in time in anything, because apparently I was really lax prior to that. So learning languages, learning new, like reading different types of books, always doing like some fiction just to help break it up and mix it up. Just really, it felt like I just really had to take on a really holistic approach to surviving that environment.
You're listening to an interview with Eric McDavid. Eric is a green anarchist who was entrapped by an FBI informant and charged with a single count of conspiracy to use fire or explosives to damage corporate and government property.
After serving nearly 10 years in prison, Eric's judgment and sentencing were vacated when it became known that the FBI had failed to disclose potentially exculpatory evidence to the defense. Eric pled guilty to a lesser charge that carried a 5-year maximum sentence, and he was released almost immediately in January of 2015.
Once you got transferred to a federal prison, I have two questions about federal prison. One is, how was it being an anarchist in prison? Did people know in the federal prison that you were an anarchist? Did that change how people related to you?
When I first got in, I mean, there's always, like, depending on, like, well, I was being at a medium, and a particularly intense medium. It was like a disciplinary yard, too. Like, heightens the intensity level of the whole experience, basically, because everyone there is like there on some real shit, and there's like very few like white collar crime or anything like that, so folks there really don't put up with anything, and they check your paperwork. Like, they will have somebody look you up and see what you're there for. Of course, it's kind of like a little shaky at the beginning with anything. But I'd learned, especially like in, even when I was in county, just to be like, you know what, this is me, this is what I do. I'm just here to do my time right now. I mean, if there's an issue, we can handle it, and that's fine. I got no problem with that. But I'm trying to do my time right now, and everyone else could do their time with that, like, being voiced in that, like, kind of upfront interaction and not beating around the bush or bullshitting with people about it. Starting out like that from the gate was really profound on folks that I had to interact with. And so, like, the biggest, like, issue that folks in prison, like, had was the issue of, like, just, like, random cannons going off. Like, people being loose, people, like, messing with other people's programs. So once they saw that I, like, had a set program that I did and I didn't vary from it, I was something that they could account for and wouldn't get in their way or wouldn't, like, be stepping on their toes and what I was doing, or wouldn't be calling attention to them and what I was doing. So it was just, there becomes, like, a place of, like, mutual respect of just like, okay, you stay in your lane, I'm going to stay in my lane. And if we can do that, we're going to ride out this time fine. People on the inside have just this really tangible and hands-on reality to where they run this certain routine. I mean, you even call it a program in there. You do certain things at certain times, at certain days, and you just stick to it because that's what turns your days into weeks, into months, into years. And especially for people who have, like, a long duration of time to do in prison, that type of pattern is really valuable and really sacred to them because it doesn't create, like, hectic and stressful interactions with other people because you know what Billy over there is doing. And you know that he's not going to mess with your workout program, or he's not going to mess with anything you have going on the side. And so I don't have to worry about Billy. I've got enough to worry about. I've got all these cops. I've got all these cameras. I've got the bullshit going on. Any type of, like, random variable is really a hard thing to take for folks that have any type of thing going on. So, I mean, there was, like, a couple of guys that I hung out with and worked out with, and, like, they were really independent too, and so, like, there was some camaraderie to be found, like, outside of, like, the general gang system or whatever, whatnot. And there's, like, always people to talk about different stuff and cultural critique, and folks are definitely open to that type of stuff in there just because there's plenty of time to talk about it, definitely. Prison also allows that little extra space in order to talk about critique and how basically fucked up this culture is on so many different levels, especially with the tangibility of the power over system from within prison.
The Prison Radio Show focuses a lot on stories of resistance on the inside, and I know you were in a federal prison during the 2011 and 2013 hunger strikes that were sweeping state prisons in California. Was there talk of hunger strikes in the place where you were in 2011 or 2013, or was that pretty much off the radar because it was a federal prison?
Yeah, it's a whole different box of beans going from federal to state. I mean, there was some talk about it, but the way that, I think right when I got there, the feds came out with a procedure to deal with hunger strike, to address it, not to deal with it, to where they put you in the shoe, hooked you up to, no, didn't even hook you up to an IV, made sure you didn't eat for 3 days, and then would strap you down and force feed you. And so where I was at, that was more than enough to keep the folks in line and like barely even talk about the hunger strike stuff that was going on.
Mm-hmm. You went on hunger strike yourself a couple times in order to get vegan food in prison?
That was actually in county jail.
Okay.
Yeah. Twice, I think one 13 day and one 12 day. Like, they just ended up giving me food after those times that I could eat. Of course, like, I messed up and not, like, getting it in writing or anything like that. There was kind of a couple of messed up tactics on my part, messed up pieces of the process on my part, to where they were actually able to, like, give me food. Like, started giving me food pretty early on. I want to say, like, the summer of 06. And then 10 days before trial on the 1st of September, they just stopped giving me food. And so it was just kind of like, oh, okay. So I think it was in 09, I got a letter from Sac County Jail saying that they were going to change their, or look into change, or beginning to change their diet to like an all vegan menu. There was some impact. It just took a little while to get.
You got out. Was it unexpected for you to get out in January? Was that a surprise for you?
Yeah, it was quite the surprise. We had no idea what the judge was going to do. He had like three basic options that he could do. One was just throw the whole thing out and say, nah, forget about it. You guys are totally off base. Don't worry about it. It's done. Go back to prison. The other one was, okay, now this is such a huge issue that we actually have to go and do another trial, which took at least another 2 years of me being in Sac County, which county jails are just the worst. And then there was the third option to where he actually followed what the agreement between the two parties had come to. And so, like, I think, and the transcripts are all there on the website too for that. And it was just ridiculous because I was like the last person in the group to have trial that day, or to go in front of the court that day. The judge, like, after about a half hour of talking about this, said he needed like a 10-minute recess, which was more like a 20-minute recess. And then we still had no idea what the devil was going to happen. And then we came back, and then it wasn't for another 20 minutes of talking that we could tell what was going to happen. And so later on, I think it was maybe 2 hours later, I got released after knowing about it. It was a little intense.
Yeah. How has it been being back on the outside? Are there some things that are easier to adjust to and some things that are harder to adjust to?
The easier things to adjust to, I've kind of like created like a nice little schedule. I got like into school, and so I'm taking like 4 classes at a local junior college. And so I've got like 2 days of classes a week. I also am doing yoga twice a week, and I found a good price for jiu-jitsu twice a week. So I'm kind of like trying to ease myself into like a less structured environment. The other easy thing for me personally is having to deal with all these bureaucracies now after 9 years of dealing with the prison system. It's super easy now to deal with bureaucracies after dealing with the Bureau of Prisons. Like dealing with like getting vehicle registration and license, and dealing with the bureaucracies within the academic system. And like that part's easy, that part's fun. Difficult parts, like relationship stuff, has been like really a challenge. But despite the challenge, the communication around it, like my communication skills, how I've been able to nourish them and like build on them more while I was in prison, has helped monumentally with that. Yeah, the hardest stuff right now is for real. I've got a like how to teach grammar for a liberal arts teacher's class, and like having to remember what a gerund is and like how to when to use like semicolons. That's like the hardest thing right now. Everything's kind of really flowing otherwise. It's nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you said at the beginning of the interview that you, I mean, I'm assuming you still identify as an anarchist because that's how you described yourself at the beginning of the interview.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like your politics changed while you were in prison, or do you feel like you kind of just built up from where you had been in 2006?
No, it's definitely built up like monumentally since then, to like a paramount degree, definitely, because like a lot of it is like power structures and being able to see that from within the prison system, and especially how this culture really reflects and refracts very well with looking at prison as like a micro of the macro of the culture. There's like far too many similarities for it to be like coincidence, and I don't believe in coincidence anymore anyway. So yeah, it's definitely like created a much deeper and thorough and more tangible critique of Western culture and the society that we live in.
So you got arrested during a time that is now called the Green Scare.
Mm-hmm.
And there are still folks who are in prison as a result of arrests that happened during that time period. And I was wondering if you could tell our listeners if you know some ways that people on the outside can support other Green Scare prisoners who are still inside.
No, yeah, definitely. Green Scare prisoners and like all political prisoners, the easiest thing to do is just drop a card. It could just be a little card, postcard that just says hi on it. I got so many of those, and every time I looked at them and read them, I would just smile. And having that type of, for real, that type of love sent in and communicated to someone on the inside is just beyond priceless. And you can feel that amazing connection that comes with people that know who you are and people that you identify with and connect with. Marius Mason, I know they're going through some difficult times right now. They would love some support. All sorts of folks, but definitely Marius. They're down in a really intense situation down in Texas right now. Please feel free to drop them a line, and if you can, like, tell him that I wish I could say hello, but of course, with supervised release, that's not possible. So if I say that I wish I could say hello, I definitely do wish that I could say hello. But yeah, just dropping a simple card is more than enough.
Thank you so much. That's all for my questions. Do you feel like there's anything that I didn't cover that you wanted to add?
Maybe just how the practice of entrapment and those tactics that have been used so efficiently and ad nauseum by the FBI and other police agencies, how there is really just a long history of that practice. And that it doesn't just exist in the political realm. I met so many people over the last 9 years who are just like, oh, they got you with that one too. Yeah, they got me. But my case was a little bit different. Yada, 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 yada. I had somebody write me recently, just go, oh, they got me with that one too. I was down in Texas and this one woman came up to me and was like looking for a place to live, and I helped her out and yada, 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 and then down that road goes. And of course there was like different means and different mediums within those practices of entrapment. But yeah, it's prolific throughout the entire so-called justice system and so-called legal system. So many other people fall prey to this tactic. It's more common than we know and realize.
Time is presently 11:47 a.m. You are listening to the Prison Radio Show here on CQT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and CQT.ca. That was an interview with Eric McDavid, a green anarchist who was sentenced to 19 years in prison after being entrapped by an FBI informant. He was released in January 2015, 10 years early, after a judge found that the prosecution had withheld evidence in his case. The music in the piece was from the band Vile Creature from St. Catharines, Ontario. Tonight there will be a vernissage for the annual Art and Anarchy exhibit as part of Montreal's Anarchist Book Fair. Featured in the vernissage will be art by Prison Radio Show contributor Peter Collins. For those of you who haven't been following his story, Peter has been diagnosed with terminal cancer and is currently fighting for compassionate release from federal prison in Bath, Ontario. You can check out his art tonight at CIDA, 2515 Rue Delisle, near Lionel Groulx Metro, starting at 6 p.m. If you can't make it tonight, you can feel free to check it out during the book fair on the third floor of the CIDA building all weekend.
Le Salon du Livre Anarchiste de Montréal.
The Montreal Anarchist Book Fair, Saturday, May 23rd and Sunday, May 24th, from 10 a.m. until 5 p.m.
Le Salon du Livre Anarchiste se tiendra dans deux bâtiments situés autour du parc Vinay, une courte distance de marche du métro Lionel Groulx. Pour des renseignements complets, consultez salonanarchiste.ca.
With participants from all over Quebec and North America, booksellers and vendors on the Saturday, workshops, films, discussions, kids' activities, art exhibits, and more on both days. Free and welcome to all.
Pour les personnes curieuses de l'anarchisme, c'est gratuit. Bienvenue à tous et toutes, le 23 et 24 mai, de 10h à 17h.
The book fair takes place at CIDA and the Georges Vanier Cultural Center, near Lionel Groulx Metro, for people curious about anarchism and wanting to learn more. For full details, visit anarchistbookfair.ca.
Ni Dieu, ni maître, ni patron, ni frontière.
This is a CKUT co-presentation.
The 16th edition of MUTEC Montreal happens May 27th to the 31st at the MAC, the Maisonneuve Theatre, two nights at Metropolis presented by Red Bull Music Academy, and a free stage outside on the parterre. Get ready for 5 days of unforgettable multi-sensory experiences with more than 110 artists, including James Holden, Richard Devine, Andy Stott, Kiasmos, Fumiya Tanaka, and Tiondai Braxton. Don't miss it. Tickets and info online at mutech.org.
This is Angela Davis. You're listening to CKUT 98.3.
Angela, you're one of a million of political prisoners in the world.
You are still listening to Prison Radio here on CKUT. We are now going to hear a couple of excerpts from a talk delivered by Christian Parenti on Taking Liberties, Prisons, Policing, and Surveillance in an Age of Crisis. Particularly, he'll be addressing a new definition of terrorism, and we'll also be speaking on the war on terror and global justice. We'll also be hearing a song about Earth First activist Judy Berry, who was car-bombed 25 years ago this weekend, in the midst of a big campaign called Redwood Summer. So again, part of the Green Scare. Also, the next Prison Radio show will air on Thursday, June 11th at 5 p.m. If you have any questions on anything that you have heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, you can contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. People can leave messages on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. If you are in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. Our mailing address is Prison Radio Show, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. Prison Radio can be heard in the following prisons: in Montreal at Tanguay, Bordeaux, Rivière-des-Prairies; in Laval at Centre de Formation Fédérale, Leclerc, Monté-Saint-François, Centre de Détention pour les Immigrants. Prison Radio can also be heard in Saint-Anne-des-Plaines, at Archambault, in Cowansville. CKUT can be heard in the U.S., in Malone, New York, at Franklin State Medium Security Prison, at Upstate Supermax Prison, and at Bear Hill Prison, which is a medium security state prison. Thank you for tuning into the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. Here is Christian Parenti on Taking Liberties.
One of the most frightening things about this is the new definition of terrorism, because a lot of this is really about, it's a mop-up operation. It's about making legal the practices that were already going on. One real breakthrough is the new definition of a terrorist. Along with all the usual stuff about hijacking airplanes and ramming them into buildings and kidnapping people, is an interesting line about anyone who breaks the law in a way that may harm human life and breaks the law in pursuit of changing public opinion or state policy can be deemed a terrorist. That's very, very broad and very clear. That means if you block traffic, quite reasonably, you may be harming your own life. If you hang a banner off a building, you very reasonably may be harming your own human life. All of that, and you're doing that for political reasons, that can be defined as terrorist. Also, aiding and abetting groups that are certified by the Attorney General as terrorists can, if you're an immigrant, as I said, get you deported, or if a citizen, get you investigated and possibly indicted.
Government tried to kill Earth First 'cause we wouldn't compromise. They thought that they could scare us and discredit our cause by using fear and violence like common outlaws. But Redwood Summer ain't gonna be stopped this way, 'cause people gonna stand together for to make a better day. No, Redwood Summer
people gonna stand together for to make a better day? People gonna stand together for to make a better day. No, Redwood Summer ain't gonna be stopped this way. 'Cause people gonna stand together for to make a better day. People gonna stand together for to make a better day. No, Redwood Summer ain't gonna be stopped this way. 'Cause people gonna stand together for to make a better day. No, Redwood Summer ain't gonna be stopped this way. 'Cause people gonna stand together for to make a better day. No, Redwood Summer ain't gonna be stopped this way. We're gonna stand together for to make a better day, for to make a better day, for to make a better day.
What is this New War on Terror? It is, I think, several things. At one level, it's a response to domestic pressure. It's just theater, right? The administration had to act. That's part of it. It's also, I think, an honest attempt, as best they can, to crush this threat. The only way they know how to do that is mass racist roundups and bombing to smithereens some other country. And third, and most importantly, it is the advance of a pre-existing agenda, which is the direct and indirect control of the entire planet under U.S. military and corporate control. That's what the militarization of Uzbekistan is all about. The U.S. had begun military ties with Uzbekistan in 1996. Now they have major military bases there. Believe me, they're not going to go away. And then there is also an element of it which I think is just excess repression. It's just people like Wolfowitz just running at the mouth and just this like crazed behavior by this huge aggressive beast that's been stung in the face and lashing out. So just a word on the pre-existing agenda, and then finally get to a sort of like a judgment on, well, what's this war going to achieve, which you all know the answer to that, right? But one thing in terms of the pre-existing agenda I just want to be clear on, I think the pre-existing agenda is more than oil, okay? Oil is really key. There's lots of oil in Central Asia. The U.S. is very interested in controlling that oil. UNICAL started trying to cozy up to Pakistan and the Taliban so as to bring a pipeline through Afghanistan in the late 90s. Bridas, an Argentine firm, did the same thing. But it's not just about oil, because even oil isn't just about oil. I mean, oil is the one commodity that touches all others. I mean,